Hi there, welcome to House to Astonish. I'm Al Kennedy.
And I'm Paul O'Brien. And in the weeks when austerity measures have seen riots on the streets of Greece, we ask, how does this affect Themyscira?
This is episode 63 of House to Astonish, and we're doing something very slightly different this time around. Usually, of course, we would have comics reviews about halfway through the podcast. This time, though, because I didn't get any comics so far for the last 2 weeks, I've actually been away on holiday, and because the comics that Paul got were desperately uninspiring, we're actually going to be going through just a bunch of stuff that we've been given on Twitter by some of our listeners and just general chat. So I hope you like hearing us talking a lot of nonsense about stuff.
It's a Q&A special. It will be about comics.
Yeah, well, there's one that's not about comics, but largely they're about comics.
They're largely about comics. But first, news.
Yeah, first bit of news. It was very, very, very sad news that Jean Colan died earlier this week. Jean Colan, one of the sort of the founding Marvel Age artists, I guess you would say. You know, one of the guys who, whilst not necessarily one of the very initial artists who was working on those books back at that point, he certainly was an early addition to that lineup, and he drew stuff like Daredevil, and he drew Iron Man, and he still was working for Marvel throughout the 70s, particularly on Tomb of Dracula.
One of the defining artists of Marvel's work in the 70s. Jean Colan's one of these guys who's hugely influential, who's one of the people who pretty much influences the Marvel house style that so many other artists copied for years to come afterwards.
Yeah, which is interesting. When you look back at the style of Marvel in the 60s and the early 70s, they were really, it was people who were being influenced by guys like Kirby and guys like John Romita, yeah. Where it's very open, lots of kind of face-on characters, lots of very big and bold layouts. In the 70s, you get guys like Gene Colan and you get guys like Neil Adams who come in and kind of shake up things like shapes of panels and how you would structure a page and how you would pose characters on a page.
And it's the sort of thing that's, as with so many of these artists who break new ground in mainstream storytelling, a lot of it nowadays looks very familiar. But if you compare it to what people were doing before, you realise that the only reason it looks familiar now is because so many people have copied those ideas and have used those techniques. There's a vast difference between Gene Colan and the Jack Kirby style that was defining Marvel in the 10 years before.
His contemporaries, his peers rather, were not so much those kind of guys like Kirby. They were guys like Alex Toth and as I say, Neil Adams, who were people who took much more, I think, from comic strips of the sort of 40s, 50s and 60s. You know, I think there's a heavy influence in Colan's early stuff of guys like Milton Caniff. At least that's what it looks like to me anyway. Although obviously he was a guy who developed his own style pretty quickly and was a guy whose own style then went on to influence so many people. People like Frank Miller's early work is very influenced by Gene Colan's work, I think. In his later years, had very bad health issues. He had very bad eye problems for a long time. He had an operation on cataracts in the early 2000s, I seem to remember. And he had personal issues as well. His second wife, there were some real difficulties there, which we don't really need to dwell on or go into. I mean, if you wanted to find out about them, then there's certainly plenty of information on the internet. But he did keep working up as basically as late as he could.
And still producing some incredibly good work.
Yeah, he did a good issue of Captain America. I think it was issue 600 or was it issue 50? I can't remember. It was around the time that they did the renumbering.
Yeah.
And I don't know how long before that he had drawn it, because it was clearly something which was not necessarily produced, you know, 3 months before it was published.
Is this issue 601, the fill-in issue that appears just before Reborn?
Yeah,
601.
Yeah, and it was a great issue. But I don't know when it had been written for him to draw. Certainly I know that towards the end of his life he was very, very ill.
Yeah.
And it's a real tragedy that he's gone now. Just another one of these comics giants who, you know, there are so many of them that are no spring chickens now, and who, you know, over the next few years, I'm sure we'll see many more of them going. And it's something that we're going to have to kind of brace ourselves for. But yeah, so that's very, very sad loss of Gene Colan. Moving on. In the wake of DC's 52, the new 52 is they're calling it.
The new 52 is now the official line for it. I think it's even got a website, thenew52.com or something like that.
I'd like to see
them. I haven't checked that.
I'd like to see them do. I'd like to see them do a superhero team. It was just 52 characters on the team, and it was called the new 52. You could have Marv Wolfman write it and George Perez draw it.
52/99.
Yes, the 52 versus the 99. It would have to be George Perez was drawing that, I think. He fits them all in tiny, tiny little... What's that way out back in the corner? Oh, that's Bouncing Boy, didn't you see? It's just a circle. Yeah. So the new 52. We've been given a bit more information on what's been going on with that, particularly on the digital side of things. We know a little bit more. Now, you had written a little bit on the blog about the...
I did
about, and particularly in relation to their what we think maybe their digital sales.
Well, yes, Dan DiDio's made comments to the retailers about what the level of digital sales actually is for DC, trying to hammer home the point to them that the bricks and mortar retailers are very important to DC because, frankly, they're doing so little business digitally that they couldn't survive or come anywhere close to it without the retailers. I think the figure he gave was that bricks and mortar sales, physical sales, were outselling digital by something like 630-1. And I checked that, and it's a figure that's given on a couple of different reports of these statements. Now, it has to be said that if you look at the printed FAQ that DC has subsequently sent out to bricks and mortar stores, the figure they give is that bricks and mortar sales account for over 95% of their sales, which is... a bit different from 630-1, but it depends how you're defining these things. If you're defining it by reference to the sales in individual titles, I can well believe that to be the case, because frankly, who in their right mind is going to wait 6 months just to buy an individual issue of Batman and Robin online? Once you take into account the sales of back catalogue stuff that's no longer in the physical market at all, things like the first arc of Secret 6, which just went up online, I can see that sort of thing may bring it up to a larger amount. But it's still pretty clear that, as things stand, digital is nowhere near being a major source of income for DC. We are still at the stage where DC are trying to build up digital to the point where it can become a major source of income. And when you hear people saying, well, why aren't they just cutting prices so that digital can be the main... Because we're not there yet, and we're not going to be there until 2013, 2014... We're miles off that point.
Yeah, it is interesting that the reason why the kind of ostensible guest reason why they're going day and date digital but at the same price as physical copies for their whole line is that they don't want to annoy the retailers. But traditionally, retailers have been, you know, treated mean by Marvel and treated nicely by DC.
It's not they don't want to annoy retailers, it's that they don't want to undermine retailers when they're still dependent upon them. It's as simple as that.
Yeah, but it's interesting that they would then go and tell retailers that, you know, we do so little business digitally, but at the same time, whether it's because they don't want to annoy them or whether it's because they don't want to undermine them, why they would think that the price that they will put these things up at in the digital store would have any effect one way or the other. If they do so little business digitally, how will it impact on a retailer?
Well, I think there's two answers to that. One is that if that is the amount of business that DC are doing digitally, then digital comics at the moment are a lot of sound and fury, which doesn't actually amount to a great deal. Mm-hmm. That means that announcing that you're going day and date digital is going to make very little difference in the real world, but will get you a lot of column inches and make things sound more important than just another renumbering. In other words, it's a good way of getting publicity for the relaunch, which is what you actually care about. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, I think that DC is not actually that bothered, at least in the short term, about people buying comics online, unless it's people who don't have access to a nearby comic store. They'd rather you bought them at the comic store in the short term. But I think what they do quite like is the idea that if there's a lot of buzz around a book and people want to buy the first issue that everyone's talking about, or if people want to jump aboard, say, four issues in and be able to go mm-hmm. back and get the early issues, that, I think, is what DC see in the short term as being the way to steer people towards digital.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think they want to move people from bricks and mortar to digital for first week sales just yet. I think what they're trying to do at the moment is build up the digital store to the point where, in due course, they can start trying to shift that sort of sale over. Somebody pointed out in the comments thread on the blog that even though the prices are meant to be the same in the direct market and online, of course, in reality, if you're a regular customer, you'll probably be given a discount mm-hmm. by your store. We certainly are. We're given mm-hmm. a massive discount yep. for pre-ordering. And therefore, it makes absolutely no economic sense for us to buy digitally.
Mm-hmm.
Frankly, I think even after they cut the price by a dollar, we're getting into areas where it's dubious whether it's there's a significant saving for us.
Yeah, I mean, I do agree that DC at the moment, as with Marvel, both companies have traditionally taken a very short-term view of their business. And this is why over the course of the years there have been enormous screw-ups. Like, I mean, you look back at Heroes World, of course, I think is probably the one that had the biggest potential to literally bring down the entire comics industry.
It came very close.
Do you know what would be fun? Sorry, just to digress here. Do you know what would be fun? DC actually exercised their right to buy Diamond.
Well, yes, they've still got that, haven't yep. they?
Yep, that's one thing that they got out of the whole Heroes World fiasco, was that DC have an option to buy Diamond. Should they wish to.
Now, that would be interesting. The thing is, DC maybe want to...
I don't think they want to. No. I think it would be a headache they don't need.
I think DC, to some extent, want to control Diamond to preserve their chain of distribution. But DC, I think, wouldn't want to use it to try and squeeze other publishers out of the direct market. Mm-hmm. That doesn't make sense for them. They need these direct market stores to be turning a profit, and they're not going to produce all of that material themselves.
Yeah, they're not going to go back to the good old days of the mid-60s where DC controlled the distributors at the time and Marvel were limited to 8 titles.
Well, exactly. I mean, DC have talked as though their aim is to get the entire line, not just the DC universe, but their entire line of monthly comics up to about 80 titles.
Mm-hmm.
That's still... something like 40 less than Marvel ship a month.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, when you look back into the mid-90s, well, not the mid-90s, really, the bubble had burst by that point, but sort of about 93, Marvel were shipping 150, 160 books a month.
Almost all of them terrible.
Oh, yeah, there just weren't enough talented creators. Like
There weren't enough competent creators.
There weren't enough people you could put bums on seats and tell them, write or draw this. You know, this is how we ended up with Chris Maranan writing and drawing Nova. Chris Maranan, who, as a writer, was a passable penciler.
Yes, well...
But anyway, sorry, going back to the topic in hand about DC and digital. I think if DC are looking at a kind of long-term view of this here, because they very infrequently do, but I think you're right, in this case, they are looking down the road a couple of years at what the landscape will look like. We're actually going to come on to talk about that in a bit more detail later on in our question and answer bit, so I'll not dwell necessarily on that point too much. But I still think that if you were to ask Dan DiDio, look, Dan, I would like to buy the first issue of The Flash, the new Flash that's coming out, Francis mm-hmm. Manapul's Flash. I can buy it for $2.99 in a shop, or I can buy it for $2.99 online in the first couple of weeks. Which would you rather I did? I think he would say, I would rather you bought it digitally because we get $3.
Well, no, they don't get $3.
Well,
the
we get
store,
more.
Because Apple take about a third.
Well, they get more than they get from the printed versions.
Well, do they? I mean, how close is it actually? When you bear in mind, they're not getting any advertising revenue from the digital copies. They've still got Comixology and or Apple taking their cut.
I wonder how they're going to how comics advertising is going to be affected by this. Because now they're going to be able to claim not only a print audience, but they're going to be able to say we have a potential audience for, you know, however many extra people digitally. I don't think it'll last much beyond the initial month or two, but I wouldn't be surprised if they're going out to advertisers now and saying, do you want to have your adverts in the first issues of the DC New 52? How much are you willing to pay for that?
Oh, I'm sure, but I mean, we've not had anyone selling adverts in their online comics, have we? I think that's one of the main advantages for the reader of buying digital, that you get rid of the adverts.
We don't. The thing is, we don't know what DC are going to do with this, with the digital versions. They may well put advertising into them.
I think you can get away with putting adverts right at the start or right at the end.
I don't think people would page past them. Do you remember when Marvel started putting up their comics online, like yonks and yonks and yonks ago, like about 8 years ago, whenever it was, and it literally was just every single page of the comic, yes, including all the adverts.
I think the,
and you had to page past them all.
The CD-ROMs, I think, still have all the adverts in them, although I think, to be fair, that there may be some technical copyright reason for that, that it's easier to get away with the licensing if they copy literally every single page, including the back cover and the statement of ownership and things like that.
On the CD-ROM versions, I'm actually quite in favour of that because they act as artifacts as well of the time. But anyway, we've gone way off of this subject. DC Digital.
They've also clarified, I think, how long they're giving each of these titles as a guaranteed run, which is basically six issues for the opening arc. So look for a massive wave of cancellations in March. I figure at least 10 of those books are going to hit the cutting room floor after six issues.
Yeah, I think someone could start running a book, actually, on which ones it would be, and they probably would clean up quite nicely on it. But, there are a few that you would look at and say, really? Wow, that's a brave choice to be publishing. And those are the ones which will be most on the bubble. And that will be a real shame, but... You know, there's some where, you know, you look at, for instance, All-Star Western is going to be it's going to be one of their $4 books because it's got extra pages in it.
But it's Jonah Hex, and yes, Jonah Hex has enough of an audience to survive.
A fan base.
I think that will survive.
I'm wondering how much of the fan base will follow it from a $2.99 book to a $3.99 book.
I think most of them will.
I wonder.
I think if they're getting extra pages... And the stories are still the same sort of thing they liked before. I think, you know, history tends to suggest that fans complain a lot when the price goes up, but they do actually pay the extra money.
Mm-hmm.
If they actually want the book, then they're not going to walk away over a $2.99, $3.99 price difference. Unless you do it across the board to such an extent that they just can't afford it anymore.
Yeah, I mean, it's a similar sort of thing happened with Captain America, where they put the Nomad backups in, though. I mean, where you would say, well, these Nomad backups, they're thematically similar. It's a Captain America-related character. People will surely be okay with this extra backup story that it's along the same sort of lines, and it's a dollar extra, and you're getting an extra 8-page story.
But the
Jonah Hex, people are like, exactly the same thing happened to Captain America, which is where people were like, well, we don't want to read this Nomad story. We don't care about Nomad. We want to read a Captain America comic.
But
are
Jonah...
people going to go, well, I just want to read a Jonah Hex comic. I don't want to read this Batlash backup or whatever.
Well, who's doing the backups? Is it the same creators? If it's the same creators,
idea.
I think they'll probably go for it. With Captain America, I think people just didn't want to read that Nomad strip.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the fact that she was technically tenuously connected to Captain America via the story that had come out in the mid-90s, I don't think that was going to make any difference.
Mm-hmm.
I think there probably is an audience that would buy a larger Palmiotti and Gray Western title.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very telling that this audience has stuck with not only this title but this creative team for 70 issues or however long it's been.
For all I know, maybe those two writers have actually been saying to DC, you know what would be nice? We've done so many Western stories where we've used Jonah Hex. It'd be quite nice to use one of the different Western characters. Sometimes we have an idea for a Western story where shoehorning in Jonah Hex just doesn't quite work.
Entirely possible. Right, so we've actually talked about this stuff for nearly 20 minutes, so we should probably move on. Marvel's big response to DC's New 52, of course, was to announce Avenging Spider-Man.
Yay.
Yeah.
It's basically Marvel Team Up. It's written by Zeb Wells. It's drawn by Joe Madureira. Now, in theory, Marvel Team Up by Zeb Wells, actually, that's not a bad pitch. Zeb Wells is a very good writer.
See, what I think you could have done there with that sentence is actually moved the punctuation slightly and said, it's written by Zeb Wells and it's drawn by Joe Madureira in theory. And then put the full stop there.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, the idea that Joe Madureira is actually going to produce a monthly comic is absurd, and everyone knows it's absurd. Mm-hmm. He's never managed to do that, even in his prime.
When he was doing X-Men, was he not knocking out a monthly comic?
No, the fill-ins all over the place.
Really?
That's the period when Roger Cruz was impersonating Joe Madureira on a regular basis.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, the book came out monthly, but it came out monthly because they used fill-in artists and fill-ins on individual pages, left, right and centre.
Mm.
Madureira's never been able to hold a regular schedule. And I think the closest he came was, let's see, what was the last major thing he did? Ultimates 3, wasn't it?
Yeah, when the delays like in Ultimates 3.
That was horrific. So, I mean, we could be wrong. It could be that for the first time in his career, he's going to get something out on a monthly basis. But I don't believe it for a second.
Yeah, he does have that. There was an interview when it was announced where Joe Madureira said, oh, about once a year, I get the urge to really, like, you know, to draw comics. Which really does explain the shipping schedule of his comics, doesn't it? It's like, well, once a year, I get the urge to draw them, so I go and draw a page.
What does he do the rest of the time?
Video games. But I don't.
Video game concept art, to be fair.
Yes, you know, he's not just playing. You know, he's, he's not just trying to get, you know, enough headshots on Modern Warfare to get an achievement. Although you never know. But yeah, it's going to essentially be a Marvel team up book where he's going to be teaming up with, I believe, primarily with Avenger characters.
Right. Well, that's half the Marvel
universe
anyway. Which
is most of the MU now, yeah.
I won't be bothering with this in monthly format. I have no faith in it coming out on any sort of sensible schedule. Mm. So, you know, if it gets good reviews, I might pick up the trade. But
yeah, same here. I mean, Zeb Wells, I would give him a lot of rope, frankly. I think he's a really good writer.
Well, he's great.
He's done some brilliant comics. He did that fantastic Lizard story, Shed, for Amazing Spider-Man, which I just thought was tremendous. And his New Mutant stuff was very good as well.
Well, yeah, I'm sure this will be a perfectly good comic when it gets around to existing, which it won't.
Back to DC, or rather to DC's other media, the Green Lantern movie opened to rapturous apathy.
It was number one in America, it was number one in Britain, but the problem for DC is that the Green Lantern movie cost them somewhere in the region of $300 million,
mm-hmm.
and it does not look to be on course to make that back, right, as of right now.
No,
I mean, it'll get there in the end, but it's going to be a long, slow crawl.
Yeah, so few films actually flop nowadays. So few films fail to make their money back.
But you know, making your money back is not that good of a result. If you've made your money back on a $300 million investment that took several years, you'd have been better off sticking it in the bank. That's a flop.
There is actually a technical definition of flop, which is that you don't make your money back, though.
Yeah.
Like, things like, people would say, oh, Waterworld was a flop. It wasn't. Waterworld made its money back.
That may be the technical definition, but the point remains...
I know it's not how people regard
that. The point remains that if you have made less money than you could have made by sticking it in the bank at a much higher risk and a lengthy delay, then it was a bad investment.
Unless you can then also... You're not just selling a movie, though, with particularly something
like
Green Lantern.
You're
selling lunchboxes and pants and...
Where are you, though?
Happy Meals.
Because the audience... I mean, the market really did tail off pretty quickly for this one. Lots of people went to see it in the first night. There was a big drop-off later in the weekend, which suggests that the word of mouth was not good.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a minority of fans of the character who maintain it's a great movie. And I think, to be honest, that kind of tells you where it may have gone wrong, that it was too much targeted to the fans. The trailers were too much targeted to the fans and not enough to the mainstream viewership.
Yeah, I mean...
And it was a bad film, by all accounts, as well.
Yeah,
I mean, not an awful film, but just a mediocre film.
Yeah. It's apparently still on track to get a sequel in all probability.
Well, they'd already commissioned a script for the sequel, and the plan at DC has been to emulate what Marvel had been doing.
Mm-hmm.
The idea was to do a Green Lantern film, do a Flash film, do some other films with their major characters, and in due course build towards a Justice League film.
They they've been very clear that's like exactly the opposite of what they're doing. The Nolan plan for Batman and Superman, it particularly, is both of these characters exist in their own universes. They will never cross over with each other or with any of DC's other characters. The Justice League film that DC have been working on
is different Batman and different Superman.
It's not just that; it's different all the characters. They were going to have different mix of characters in there.
That's insanely stupid.
It really is dumb. I would have thought that doing the Marvel thing and building to a Justice League movie with, you know, Wonder Woman and Flash and Green Lantern, whoever.
I would have thought just don't do the Justice League, actually. Just do the individual characters.
Well, if that's what they're going to... That seems like that's what they're going to do. But if they were going to emulate Marvel, then they would need to get Batman and Superman in there. You can't go, here's all our big characters except for the two that are really famous.
I think the thing is, Batman and Superman are their two strongest characters. Mm-hmm. Green Lantern, Flash, you're into characters who are basically, you know, endless variations on gimmicky use of their powers. Mm-hmm. Wonder Woman, I still think, is basically just a bit of a mess conceptually and quite difficult to tidy up as anything more than a camp icon for a modern audience. She's one of these characters like Doctor Doom or the Silver Surfer, where if you're into comics, you're so used to the character that you kind of take the inherent absurdity and the clunkiness of it in stride.
Silver guy on a surfboard is risible.
Yeah.
But it works in the comics.
In the same way that everybody in Britain thinks Top of the Pops is a perfectly good name for a TV show, when it's obviously a very bad one. And I think, you know, Wonder Woman is one of those concepts that you become so used to it being treated by everyone as a good idea that you have to think back from the perspective of somebody who's not been raised to think of a character that way. And you think, what is there about this character that is actually any good, other than the fact that she's the only female superhero in a genre that's otherwise desperately short of them? That's not a good enough thing to build around, because you can always build a better female superhero.
Mm-hmm.
You can very easily build a better female superhero than this god-awful mess of concepts of Greek mythology and weird, you know, misplaced American patriotism and the strange views on feminism of an odd man of the 1940s.
Yep. Who likes tying people up with lassos and so on.
It's just she's a very odd character.
She really is. And when you look at characters like Green Lantern, DC have obviously looked at Iron Man's success and thought, right, Iron Man is a B-list Marvel character, essentially, to the wider world. You know, Marvel have only got a few A-list characters. You've got Spider-Man, they've got the Hulk. To an extent, I guess they have Wolverine now on the back of the X-Men movies. Pre the X-Men movies, they didn't have Wolverine as a super well-known character. Nowadays, they really do. And part of that is because Hugh Jackman, on the back of those movies, went on to become an enormous film star and still kept coming back and doing X-Men movies.
But the character doesn't have to be already A-list if the premise is strong enough. That's why they got several movies out of Blade. Blade's never been a big character, but the concept's decent enough that you can get a few movies out of that.
See, and this is one of the places where we completely diverge, I think, is that you think that Green Lantern is a fundamentally stupid idea, and I think it's actually fundamentally a brilliant idea. But, it's Magic Wishing Ring. That's a fantastic idea for a character for a film. But what happens is it gets tied into nonsense about emotional spectrums and guys who have big, tall, purple heads and twiddly moustaches. And, you know, the whole thing in the Green Lantern movie, Sinestro doesn't go evil until the post-credits scene.
Mm.
Was anyone surprised that the character called Sinestro, played by the English guy in a Hollywood movie with a tiny little evil moustache, turns evil?
I think, to be fair, they might be surprised by the fact that he doesn't turn evil until the post-credits scene.
That's a twist ending.
That is a twist ending. The character called Sinestro turns out not to be evil, although actually he does.
He's like, I actually had a complete change of heart, and I've spoken to the guys in the Green Lantern Corps marketing division, and they think that people maybe are not taking me quite seriously enough as a force for good and like, you know, helping people out in the cosmos, because I'm called Sinestro and I've got a tiny little evil moustache. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to grow a gigantic Galifianakis-esque beard, and I'm changing my name to Niso.
Remember how Captain Marvel, the original Marvel version of Captain Marvel, was an alien called Mar-Vell?
Mm-hmm.
I think it would be great if his name had been something like Captain Genocide. And he was like, what? What? Why does no one take me seriously as a good, as a doer of good?
Oh, I'd love to see that. But yes, I can't, we've gone completely off track here as well, haven't we? Yeah, the Green Lantern movie. It'll get its sequel, I have absolutely no doubt. What the box office of this will mean for how DC's movies are budgeted, and particularly how they're promoted in future, I don't know.
Well, mate, you can make a movie for a lot of DC's characters a lot more cheaply than they did with Green Lantern. They hold a special effects budget at Green Lantern. On one view, they made a fundamental mistake in bringing in the core in the first movie at all. It would have been arguably a stronger movie if you just have Hal Jordan discovers the ring. Mm-hmm. And, you know, doesn't actually make proper contact with the Corps until the next movie, and you do the discovery of his powers, etc., etc. I still think they'd have been better off actually just not using Hal Jordan and using one of the more interesting characters from later in the
Honestly, I think they should have used John Stewart, because outside of...
He's in the cartoon.
Well, he's in the cartoon, and he's the merchandised Green Lantern. You know, he's the guy, up until this movie anyway... He was the guy who, because of the Justice League, he was on, he had all the toys of, he was the one that was on the lunchboxes and the pants and the cereal and all that kind of thing. Kids knew John Stewart. If they knew Green Lantern at all, it was John Stewart.
And did they not actually get some feedback from the preview screenings of people saying,
why
did
they
make
him white? It's just, it's comics movies being made too much for a comics reading audience and not for a movie going audience. And people say, oh, what? Oh, they've changed it. Oh, they've changed it for the film. Oh, I can't believe they're not being faithful to the comics. Your comics still exist. Raymond Chandler was asked, and this is possibly apocryphal, but Raymond Chandler was asked during an interview, how do you feel about Hollywood destroying all your books? And he is reputed to have turned and looked at the bookcase and said, nope, they're all still there.
Geoff Johns was one of the high-level execs working on this film, though in fairness, apparently it was already in train before he came aboard. Mm-hmm. He still had an awful lot of input on it. You do have to question whether Geoff Johns has clearly demonstrated an ability to appeal to the core superhero audience. Does he have the same knack when it comes to a broader mainstream audience? Is he going to steer DC films in too narrow a direction? We don't know. One film is not a fair judgment.
Yeah, absolutely.
We'll have to wait and see what happens with the next one. But Flash?
See,
Flash
the thing
gonna
is,
work?
I worry that the Flash movie will have, you know, the main baddie will be the Reverse Flash, but it'll also have the Rogues in there, and they'll put in Impulse, and they'll put in Max Mercury, and they'll put in Barry and Wally. And, you know, it's like with this film here, you've got the core plus Hal plus Hector Hammond plus Parallax plus Oa plus the batteries plus the emotional spectrum stuff getting brought in with the yellow ring. The whole thing is just, let's cram as much in there. I mean, did we learn nothing from Batman and Robin? You know, you add in Chris
Make
O'Donnell,
gay,
you add in Chris O'Donnell, then you add in Alicia Silverstone, then you have two different villains in the film. It's just far too crowded. When you look at Iron Man again,
keep it simple.
It's one guy, one baddie, a very straightforward plot. You know, even when you got Iron Man 2, you've got ostensibly two baddies, but Justin Hammer essentially is just an annoyance. He's not really anything that, you know, he exists in that film to facilitate Whiplash's plot and to give him the impetus to move along.
And you've got the Black Widow in there, but again, she's effectively a supporting character. You know, there's a fairly clear through line.
The Black Widow is one of the things that actually annoys me a bit about Iron Man 2, not because I think Scarlett Johansson is bad or because the character is bad, but because she's so obviously in there to be a setup for the Avengers. And I know why they have to do that, because they're introducing a lot of characters that, if they're going to do an ensemble movie, you can't just have an ensemble movie that's three or four guys. Mm. And then you're introducing suddenly four other characters in the Avengers. I mean, it's why Hawkeye is seeded into Thor, for example. But at the same time, as an individual movie-watching experience, you do kind of go, did she add very much to that film?
We've already rambled some way off the news. Let's officially ramble some way off the news and answer some questions from Twitter.
Yeah, we've got some topics of discussion. Mark Clapham has asked us, actually asked if we would review the new series that followed Zero Hour.
Would we
have bought Fate Issue Zero?
What was specific about Fate Issue Zero?
Well, Fate was... I think Fate is kind of a... just an example, really, of they're doing a new version of an existing old character and sort of launching a low-tier book. You know, it's like if Marvel were to do their 52, would we have bought issue one of Cloak and Dagger if they were launching 52 books? You know,
I probably would have bought a first issue of Cloak and Dagger, yeah. I mean, I was thinking, what would you put in Marvel's line of 52? And actually, if you want to pare down the Avengers titles, you mean... You could. There's plenty of dormant Marvel properties that haven't been used in a while.
Mm-hmm.
People always say, oh, everything gets relaunched again and again. There are Marvel properties that don't get brought back. Dazzler, for example, mm-hmm. A long run, never seems to get brought back.
Yeah.
They
couldn't make Spider-Woman work again.
Well, they keep trying with Spider-Woman.
Well, she's only had her own title again once. I mean, yes, there was another Spider-Woman book, but that was Byrne Spider-Woman, and that was Matty Franklin. It was a completely different character.
Sure, but there have been a few... Well, there was the Bendis one, Bendis Maleev last year.
Yeah, that ran seven issues and stopped. That's what I'm saying, they couldn't make it work. Part of the fact they couldn't make it work was because they had Alex Maleev doing the stupid motion comic thing. And it was just way too much work for him to get a book out.
But there have been a few reasonably long-running titles that Marvel don't keep trying to bring back again and again. Wonder Man had a decent run in the 90s.
Iron Man and Iron Fist. I mean, I know I'm speaking here from self-interest, but 125 issues of that book.
They've recently tried with a new...
Well, they gave it a five-issue miniseries.
They're using the character again in Fear Itself, Homefront, though. I think they are trying to do something with him.
Mm-hmm.
Dark Hawk. Red Wolf. Red Wolf had a short-lived ongoing series in the 70s.
Yeah, I think that was about six or seven issues.
Kazar. Oh, Kazar.
Kazar's not had a book since 97.
He's not an ongoing series. Mm-hmm. Yeah, true. They haven't had an ongoing Silver Surfer title in a while either. Actually.
Oh, yeah. Doctor Strange, for goodness sake. I mean, when was the last time he had an ongoing again
quite
in the 90s?
Quite a while ago. But anyhow, where were we?
We're listing
the DC the DC relaunch of Zero Hour. I remember the Zero Hour relaunch. I bought almost none of those issues. The problem for me with Zero Hour was that Zero Hour was promoted as being, here's the miniseries where we're going to clear up the mess of continuity we made in the aftermath of Crisis. This isn't a reboot. This is a continuity fix where we try to undo the damage we did to our own universe.
Mm-hmm.
And as I recall, the way it was pitched was, we're going to have this story which is a justification for tinkering with continuity, and then we're going to have an entire month of origin books which will tell you what the continuity is post, mm-hmm. post-Zero Hour. And for me, as somebody who wasn't an existing reader of DC Comics or who didn't buy many DC books at the time, that was of absolutely no interest at all, because effectively they were just marketing this as, we are now going to explain to you this month what history is. It wasn't sold as, these are going to be great comics. It wasn't sold as, this is something exciting and new. It wasn't sold as, here's great new creative teams. It wasn't even sold as, here's where you jump aboard the series. It was sold as, here's where we're going to restate continuity and try to dig ourselves out of a hole.
Yeah, I do like the idea of Black Hawk History Month, though. Mark also says, after the reboot, should Geoff Johns do a six-issue series making Alfred fat again?
Yes.
I'd like to see that. Fat Alfred and the Cosby Kids. Gary Halpin says, could we talk about the cancellation of Secret Six? Now, this obviously was not one of the new relaunch books.
Yep.
I suppose it's because Gail can only write so many pages a day and they've got her doing other titles.
Now, I haven't been reading Secret Six.
I have. I think it's very good.
Does
but,
it seem to have come to a natural end point?
Yes. It's wrapping up a story in a sensible way.
If this had been the point where Gail Simone had simply left the book anyway, it hadn't been a relaunch, mm-hmm. line-wide relaunch, it does feel like a point where Gail Simone's run might have been coming to its end, mm-hmm. anyway, and she would have handed over to a new writer and gone off to a different project.
Well, it's difficult to say. I mean, what it feels very much like is when she left Birds of Prey.
Well, hold on.
The first time round.
Oh, okay.
Not this time round. No. No, it's when she left Birds of Prey the first time round, and it went to, was it McKeever first and then Bezzard? Or the other way around? Can't remember. But it was eventually Sean McKeever and Tony Bezzard wrote that book. And she wrote the story to the conclusion of her story arcs. but didn't, you know, put the toys in the box or anything like that. You know, it was left for the other writers to go on with. The way that Secret Six is wrapping up, I'm not sure that that would have been as easy. It does look like the concept is coming to a wrap up.
It may be that because she knows the book's ending, she's in a position to do a more definitive resolution to her stories than she might otherwise have done. But it seems to me that I like series just to run their natural course. And when the writers finished their storyline, however many years that takes, if you want to cancel the book at that point, fine, because the story's over.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's where Secret Six has come to, then even if it's a great book, end it.
Yeah, I mean,
let Gail Simone do something else. And they're hiring her to do several other titles.
Yeah, so many books should get the chance to just stop, and so few of them do. Yeah. And the fact that Secret Six is getting a chance to have a kind of staged wrap up and a proper safe landing, that's great, I think. If they're going to stop doing it, and they are, then, you know, let her finish writing it.
I mean, yes, it's by all accounts a great book. I've no doubt that's true. But if it would be coming back with a different creative team anyway, then the fact that it's great would be irrelevant because it would be a new creative team.
Mm-hmm.
If Gail Simone would have been wrapping up all her storylines otherwise in, say, 6 to 7 months, again, there's no point doing a jumping on point now. It's just so that she can finish off in early 2012. It may well be a book that has reached a natural point for it to finish. I'd be a lot more concerned if there weren't any Gail Simone comics post the relaunch than if there weren't any Secret Six comics.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm looking forward to seeing what she does with Firestorm. You know, we've talked about the Batgirl thing before. It's coming to a conclusion. I like the book a lot, but I'm not sad to see it go the way that it's going.
Yeah.
Gary's also asked if we'd talk about River Song. Did you watch Doctor Who this year?
I watched it on and off, yes. I haven't really been following Doctor Who the last few years.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think Matt Smith's a fantastic actor. I think River Song's a very clever idea for a character, even if it's essentially the same idea as the time traveller's wife.
I would catch up with some of the later episodes. It was teased as the same concept as the Time Traveller's Wife. It's not. There's a huge swerve.
Crossed with Benjamin Button, or whatever it was.
Again, not so much. are you planning on watching any of it?
Not really.
Well, in that case then, spoilers for Doctor Who, everybody. But I think it was quite... it was making River Song... Amy and Rory's daughter was something which is clever. It's a twist that a lot of people, I think, saw coming.
Which is fine. Sometimes that's satisfying when you see it resolved the way you want.
I saw people complaining online about, ooh, totally guessed that. And it's like, oh, great, well done. You paid attention. You know, it shouldn't be something that leaps out of the bushes and batters you. You know, it's okay for you to have guessed what's going to happen.
In an audience of millions, in a show that's aimed at children primarily, mm-hmm. or aimed at an audience intended to include children, if the entire audience can't see it coming, then, you know, it's probably been made too obscure.
Yeah, if you made the whole British nation sit there and go, what? Then you're doing it wrong, your kids' TV show. Ian Hepburn asks, how long does the printed comic book industry have left before it goes fully digital?
Oh, a good few years.
I reckon comics...
Well, first of all, there will always be printed editions of things like the Absolute Sandman variety.
Yeah.
Even in the days when things have gone primarily digital, I think there will still be people wanting prestige format collections to have on their bookshelves as collectibles. I think the more interesting question is, how long will it be before the monthly weekly grind shifts to being a principally digital format, and how long before, once that happens, the publication format as we know it sort of just dies off entirely?
Mm-hmm. Well, and indeed, how long before the publication format as we know it, which has been transplanted onto the internet, dies out? How long before they realise that they don't have to do 22 pages of those dimensions? You can have individual panels, you can have, you know, much longer pages, you can have much shorter pages. The internet is, you know, is infinite. Your scroll bars go off in all directions as far as you need them to go. I think chaining yourself to this dimensions and this page number is an artificial restraint imposed by the fact that what we are seeing online at the moment are digital versions of existing print comic books.
That's
or things which are intended to be eventually be published as print comic books.
That's a point that Scott McCloud's been making since Reinventing Comics came out. But while he's done some interesting proof-of-concept comics demonstrating what you can do with a browser window, fundamentally it's never really taken off. And I think we're a long way off people trying to reinvent the entire way in which you read comics by taking advantage of scrolling. The last time we had people trying to seriously reinvent comics using browsers, what we ended up with was people trying to tell us that what they produced was enhanced comics, and what they had actually produced was crap animation.
Yeah, I think comics fans will keep the printed format, the monthly printed format, hanging on a lot longer than it really needs to, because if there's one thing that comics fans are, it's nostalgic and attached to things that they remember.
For this change to happen, what's got to happen realistically is that, first of all, you've got to build up the digital channels to the point where Marvel and DC feel confident in cutting the price and are able to throw the direct market to the wolves. We're obviously quite some way off them even attempting that. Even then, there'll be a residual support for the direct market for some time to come. The other possibility is that you get a massive influx of new readers from areas, for example, who don't have ready access to a comic shop, who will buy digitally. But I don't see that happening at $3.99 or $2.99. Yeah. It's talked up, I think, too much as being something which is imminent. I think it's a medium-term thing. It's certainly not a short-term thing. Yeah. And by medium-term, I'm thinking, you know, 5 years maybe.
I would even suggest beyond that, before the printed monthly comic book becomes a thing of the past. I think it will be beyond that.
Well, I think there will come a point where the lower-end titles may go entirely digital. In the same way that when the direct market started, you got a handful of books that were direct market exclusive. I think what will be interesting is when you start getting Marvel or DC launching a in-continuity, reasonably mainstream title as something which is a direct market exclusive, as were back in the day, what, Dazzler was the first.
Yeah, and Moon Knight.
Weirdly enough, Moon Knight Power Pack, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
I can see that sort of thing being the next step beyond day and date, something which is made a digital exclusive. But yeah, it's going to be a slow progress. I think it'll be first a sort of third tier title like a Moon Knight, and then after that maybe one of these things which would otherwise have been a miniseries selling 7,000 copies. And that's the point where you'll start seeing signs of a tipping point.
The thing is, if they start moving larger, they might say, well, let's put one of our bigger characters on there as well. Let's do Spectacular Spider-Man is going to be our digital Spider-Man comic. We're still going to keep publishing Amazing Spider-Man physically. Spectacular Spider-Man has to, quote-unquote, count.
Yes, I mean, they've done online exclusives before for Marvel
and
Digital.
Nobody cared at all.
Because they were so obviously just additional filler material. And they all came out in print a few months later anyway.
And a lot of them were behind the wall of the Marvel Digital Comics Unlimited thing anyway.
So they were there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not suggesting something like that. Nor am I saying it necessarily has to be a situation where they make life impossible for fans by having part four of a 16-part crossover available only online. I'm talking about, you know, something which is a proper Marvel Universe title, but also entirely self-contained, going online, something like a Doctor Strange relaunch or something like that. If they said, we're relaunching Doctor Strange, it's going to be a full 22-page monthly and it's going to be exclusively online, something along those lines, that's the tipping point where you're starting to see them take digital seriously. That's not going to happen for ages.
I think it would have to matter to the universe, though. Not our universe, but like the Marvel universe. It would have to be something where, as I say, if you've got two Spider-Man books and one of them is online, then if you don't have, you know, Amazing Spider-Man's got a bit where it's saying, oh, I have to go and visit Aunt May in hospital after she got hit by that truck, and it says, you know, a little editorial box to find out more about Aunt May getting hit by a truck, visit Marvel.com.
I'm not sure about that, because for example, during the time J. Michael Straczynski was writing Amazing Spider-Man, it completely ignored everything that happened in the other two books. I think you'd be you've got to have your online product be something on a par with those. It's not enough for it to be a 7-page here's what else Spider-Man did this month thing. It's got to be something that looks like at least the equivalent of, say, Peter David's Friendly Neighbourhood Spider-Man.
It's got to be something where you feel like if you're not reading it, then you're probably missing out on more of the adventures of your favourite character. You know, it has to be, for you know, better or worse, it has to be explicitly in continuity.
Yes,
and
it does.
I wish it didn't have to, but it will have to, because that's just what comics fans are like.
Or it's got to be by a really A-list creative team.
Yeah. Matt Craig asked us to talk a little bit about the UK newsagent comics landscape post-Panini, pre-Phoenix. Now, Panini have had their license yanked for original Marvel material.
Ah, yes.
For they had the Spectacular Spider-Man comic, etc. And, you know, they still have the license to do the reprint stuff, which sells gangbusters for them. They do really well off the newsstand with that stuff. But they don't produce original stuff anymore. They're not going to be producing original stuff anymore.
So who are Phoenix?
Phoenix is the revived version of the, what was it, DFA or whatever it was called, the one that was the kids' comic that lasted a year or so. I can't remember exactly how long. It was a sort of an independent thing. It was, you know, it was a lot of talented, mainly young British comics writers and artists, and it's coming back as this comic, Phoenix. But it's that's not around yet. But the UK comics landscape and newsagents is what, 2000 AD in the magazine, which will go forever.
DC Thompson.
Yes.
Still there, clinging in.
Yeah. A lot of kind of licensed titles with water pistols stuck to the front, if it helps you. Clint, I guess.
Does that even count?
Well, that's part of the UK comics. I mean,
I
suppose back
it
in the
is,
day,
yes.
Deadline counted as part of the UK comics.
Yeah, true. But we still have a situation where fundamentally what UK creators aspire to is to be published by Americans.
Mm.
Unless you're working in a particular idiom where it's, you know, such as the Beano. If you're working in a particular style, it's pretty clear that that's where you're going, where you can aspire to be.
Yeah, we should say that this is for comics sold commercially in shops. I mean, there are, you know, newsagents and so on. There is a huge and vibrant UK independent comics industry.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think you would even call it an industry, but, you know, a huge and vibrant UK independent comics community producing brilliant work.
Absolutely.
But they're not on sale in WH Smith.
No, and if they're going to get published by somebody major, it's probably going to be Image or something like that. Mm-hmm. There's no UK equivalent of Image.
No, I mean, when you get things like...
Titan is about as close as you're going to get if you want to get your book published in a reasonably major way entirely within the UK.
Yeah, I mean, you've got... Panini bought Marvel UK years ago. And they have been a force which is around for a very, very long time producing stickers, etc. 50 years!
They're a collectible sticker album company, fundamentally.
50 years they've been around, according to the little slug that's been on the front of their publications. Can you imagine what it'd be like doing that same thing 50 years? I mean, people just don't get bored of it.
What should we do this year? Football?
That difficult second album.
Yeah.
Boom, boom.
That's awful.
I'm sorry. But they are something that is not going anywhere, Panini. It's a company that is firmly entrenched and has its niche, and people seem to still be buying stickers somehow. You still see them for sale in newsagents.
And they have newsstand penetration as well because of their sticker business.
Yep, and they are the ones who do all these Marvel reprints.
Which are quite good value, actually. If you don't mind the fact they're several years old, they're really quite good value.
Yeah, and this is something that Marvel themselves are branching out into doing now.
Oh, yes,
because
in America
they've announced a ton of them. Absolute ton of these things. Including one called Marvel Family, which I'm sure DC will be interested to learn is something that they're going to be producing.
Yeah, they're all called things like Marvel X, Marvel Y. I thought they were very samey names. I think you'd look at all these things launching on sitting on the shelf in, I don't know, what replaces Borders in America? It used to be Borders.
Well, I mean, they'll still sell them in Walmart or places like that.
If you look at all these things, they've all got very similar names. I thought they were very bland, uninspired names.
Well, this is how it works. If you've ever been in newsagents in, for instance, France, the comics there are all called things like, you know, Marvel Hero or Marvel whatever. They're all very basic kind of names. And yes, they are now moving also quite firmly towards producing individual character titles that only print that character's adventures. But the compilation ones that, you know, they used to do, like, you know, Fantastic Four and Captain America and Thor or whatever. Yeah. And that would be called something like Marvel Select or something like that.
I think you can get away with having one or two titles of that sort, but
yeah,
they'd announce something like 15 of
yeah,
them. And that you can't have that many titles which are all called Marvel Insert Random Word Here.
Mm-hmm.
Marvel Table.
Yeah.
Marvel Chair. Marvel Window.
On the UK original material front, though, you have to produce either kids' comics servicing old trademarks, or you have to produce stuff for 2000 AD or for Clint. Phoenix is not yet around. We will have to see if that gets any traction. But yeah, it's after the Panini's original superhero material has been taken away from them, it's taking away a small part of a small market, I think.
Yeah, there's a certain type of material that can still do well on the UK newsstand, but there's awful lot of other genres. You're just better off either going through the American distribution channels or resigning yourself to trying to get straight into the book publishing trade.
Because very, very few British newsstand comics are just pure comics things. I mean, most of them are, you know, here is a feature about the cartoon that you like, and then here is a puzzle page about this thing, and, you know, here is
Mr. Bounce or whatever.
They're a mixture of comics and lots of other things. They're almost magazines for kids, really, rather than comics.
Absolutely.
For kids.
It's very heavily weighted even towards the preschool market, frankly, the UK newsstand.
Mm. Matt's also asked us if we have any unexpected favourite artists. Like, I presume he means like artists that we didn't expect we would like.
Why would I? I mean, I suppose that would
have
to be
someone who you didn't like originally and who has become a favourite artist. For me, that's Pascal Ferry.
Yes, he used to be really quite mediocre.
And he started doing X-Men fill-ins when Roger Cruz couldn't keep his schedule. He wasn't any good at all. But he then became a guy who was one of my favourite comics artists.
I'm trying to think of somebody I've actually changed my mind on. Because, yeah, I'm never that surprised when I see somebody I've never seen before.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody who started off with rubbish and got much better.
Chris Cross was another guy who was like that for me. I didn't like his early to mid-90s stuff, but he really grew on me as his style evolved and matured.
I don't remember what his early stuff looked like, to be honest.
You know how Chris Cross's characters have got very round faces and very round eyes? It was like that, but even more so. They all looked like Mr. Men.
Adam Kubert, he started off pretty uninspiring, and I thought he'd actually become quite good over the years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting when a comic book artist's style so dramatically changes. Mike Mignola is an obvious example of that.
John Romita Jr.?
Ah, yeah.
Some of his earlier stuff is unrecognisable as being from the same guy.
Mm.
I think I probably preferred the work he was doing, you know, about 15 years ago, actually. Things like his run on Daredevil. But that, I mean, you'd struggle to recognise that as being the same artist who was doing the occasional book 10 years previously.
Even guys like, I guess, you know, Silvestri, when he was doing his X-Men stuff, it was a lot rougher and it was a lot more...
I actually
more...
prefer Silvestri's X-Men stuff.
Like,
because it's,
yeah,
I think his later stuff is
well.
So much
his,
more over-rendered.
Yeah, his stuff now is very much the kind of everybody's got these unbelievable cheekbones and the exact same length of stubble. Anyway... adaptations that we would like to see either into comics or out of comics.
Ooh.
I still want to see that Bone movie.
Is there a Bone movie actually
planned?
There
was going to be a Bone movie. Nickelodeon were going to make it. It fell through. It was going to be taking its cues more from Ghibli than from Disney. There were going to be no songs. It was going to be, you know, it was going to be an animated Lord of the Rings, essentially, which, you know, Bone is very much a Lord of the Rings style quest story.
I wouldn't mind seeing the notional HBO version of Sandman. I think it's one of those things where if you were going to adapt it, that's the sort of format it would work in. I think you'd have to hurl money at it.
Mm.
But I think that would be quite interesting to see.
Mm. I'm looking forward to seeing what the Chew TV series is going to be like, the Showtime or two.
That should be interesting. I think it'll probably be changed quite dramatically. But
James Hunt asks, could we read the issues of Batman Odyssey that are out and explain what's going on?
No,
to both, really. I read the first issue and didn't want to read any more.
What is it?
Go to Comics Alliance. It's Neil Adams' Batman thing.
Oh.
Yeah. Go to Comics Alliance and look for the exploration of the six published issues of Batman Odyssey that they did. It is hilarious. It is a brilliant bit of writing. And it's all completely factually accurate as far as I can tell. Greg Arujo says, could we discuss this summer's comic book movies? I mean, we've discussed Green Lantern already. Did you see X-Men First Class yet, by the way?
I have not seen it.
It's very good.
I've heard good things about it.
I really recommend going to see it. It's very enjoyable.
We saw Thor, and I thought that was actually pretty good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was quite entertained by that. The new trailer for Captain America looks amazing.
I think it's going to be very interesting to see how they market Captain America overseas.
Mm-hmm.
Because, obviously, they're... I'm not saying that Captain America is unmarketable mm-hmm. overseas, but clearly there's a certain tone of flag-waving that you want to avoid.
The tagline on this new trailer that was... I don't know if it's just an American trailer or whether we're going to be getting a different one, but the tagline is, this summer, heroes are made in America.
Oh, God. Oh, no.
Yeah.
No, they can't use that tagline in abroad. That's not going to work at all.
Mm.
I mean, the one thing that you cannot do with Captain America is send the message of, hey, for people from Britain, France, etc., come and watch America telling you how awesome it is for 2 hours.
Mm.
It'll be in 3D.
Yeah.
You'll be able to see that flag waving right in your face.
Greg also asked about titles that we've recently rediscovered.
Rediscovered?
For me, it's Morrison's Batman. I've been buying Batman Inc. I hadn't been buying the previous stuff, Return of Bruce Wayne and Batman RIP and all that. I fell off of the Batman bandwagon after Batman and the Black Glove story, the Club of Heroes thing that J.H. Williams drew, and that was really, really good, but I stopped buying it at that point. And I've actually gone back now and bought all of Morrison's stuff, up to and including the Batman and Robin stuff, and I'm now back on board on a monthly basis with Batman Incorporated.
And how does it work read as a whole? Is it one of these things
so much better than in monthly? Like, if you sit down, take an afternoon, read all of it through, you notice so much more that is important to the story, because it's a little bit annoying. It's clearly been written for the trade paperback collection and for you to go back and look at your trades after the third trade down the line comes out, you know, because there are so many points where there's a little throwaway line which looks like it's not important at all. It's an oblique reference to somebody that's not important. And then a year later, it's a plot point.
His X-Men was the same.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, for instance, that the fact that you can... if you knew what you were looking for, work out that Zorn was Magneto before the reveal happened.
You can certainly work out that he's not the person he claims to be, at least. I'm not sure you can necessarily work out he's Magneto. There's a lot of things that are consistent with it when it's...
That exploration that you did on Usenet a few years back, where, like, every couple of paragraphs you're like, and how do Magneto's powers work again? Exactly like this.
Yes. True. Rediscovered. That's kind of implying something that I've gone away from and then jumped back aboard. And to be honest, I've completely got out of the habit of trying to jump onto series when they're already in progress because I've given up trying.
Mm-hmm.
The industry's made me give up on it. I jump on maybe when it's a new series or maybe at the start of a creative team, but I don't really regard that as rediscovering a title.
Anything that you'd gone back onto because you'd heard good word of mouth about it?
No, because it's already underway and you can't get the earlier issues, so why bother?
Enough.
I honestly believe Marvel and DC have trained me not to bother trying. Which is one of the reasons why I think it's actually a good idea that DC are going to make their back catalogue so readily available.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's also a good idea for them to be trying to win people like yourself back into their fold by doing this New 52. Because if there was ever a point where they're saying, you honestly don't need to have read anything before this.
Saying it.
This is now... Well, they're saying it. Yeah, let's see what happens. Oh, yeah, our old mate and former boss at Ninth Art, Andrew Wheeler, has got a couple of questions. He says, should superheroes have tattoos?
It works for Iron Fist.
Depends. Yeah, well, is that really a tattoo? That's a brand. That thing on his chest. He got it from pushing himself up against a molten hot heart of a dragon.
I think it depends on the character. And there's some characters where it works perfectly well, and there's some where it looks like a rather pathetic attempt to seem relevant and edgy.
Some characters, like, I could see if they gave Dazzler a tattoo, or, to be honest, even if they gave Tony Stark a tattoo, I think it probably... Because Tony Stark has his tattoo, that'd be part of his midlife crisis.
I think a story where Tony Stark wakes up from another drunken stupor to discover that he's had the words "I am Iron Man" tattooed on his forehead.
Just Black Sabbath rules.
I think it depends on the character. I don't know why... If it works for the character, if it feels like something they would have done, then why not?
Yeah, I mean, I think it wouldn't work for Superman, but it would work for Superboy.
Yes.
And that is the way they appear to be going with Superboy, is they're giving him a tattoo.
It would work with some of the X-Men, but not others. I mean, it would the character do it?
It'd be so funny watching Wolverine trying to get a tattoo, and just, like, he has to keep going back and redoing it.
Well, they gave him...
Like the fourth row bridge.
You jest, but remember, they gave him tattoos in Ultimate X-Men. And they gave tattoos to Jay Ken, even though he's got a healing factor, because it looks good. Now, that's stupid, because you then have to come up with an explanation for why Jay Ken's healing factor is somehow able to distinguish between injuries and ink, which is the official explanation, by the way.
Really? He's got a sentient healing factor?
No, the official explanation is that a tattoo is not an injury, and that's why the healing factor doesn't affect it.
Right.
Which I suppose makes a certain degree of sense, in the same way that Wolverine's healing factor didn't just expel his adamantium of its own accord.
I guess. But, and, you know, Wolverine has a healing factor. He heals back from things much, much faster than you would normally heal back from them. In real life, in normal everyday, you don't heal from a tattoo. It is just there. It stays there. So it's not something that you heal from anyway. That's not how healing works, I guess. Who should have redesigned DC's costumes, Andrew asks. Because the redesigns that they've got from Jim Lee, bless him. By all accounts, lovely guy, very good comics businessman, still, I think, a very good artist. Terrible costume designer, and always has been.
It's never been his strong point, and I think it's also just a mistake in general to have all of your characters redesigned by the same artist. Mm-hmm. I think you want a range of different influences so that the characters in different books actually look like they have their own identity. Mm-hmm. There's too much of a risk if you have them all designed by the same artist that what you end up with is the same sensibility coming through again and again.
Yeah, it's less like a bunch of people who have, you know, either created their own costumes or, you know, part of some group that have their own, you know, individual groups that have their own costumes. It's more like, you know, if you've got a car manufacturer, they may have different models of car, but they are all, you know, recognisably manufactured by that one car manufacturer. If everybody's got the same little touches on their costumes, these little V-necks, for instance.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it sounds like a cop-out, but in many ways the short answer is whichever artist is going to be drawing them regularly. And it ought to be, you know, ideally costumes that work with their style. With one caveat, which is that it also needs to be a costume design that can easily be adapted for other artists' style and can be made to works when the character is used in licensed properties and so forth.
Yeah.
You don't necessarily want to end up with a costume design like a character design like some of the things Bill Sienkiewicz did on New Mutants, where, for example, Warlock has been a plague for every other artist who's come along since, because just trying to work out what he actually looks like when he's drawn by somebody other than Bill Sienkiewicz is a problem. And I would want to make sure that you didn't get people creating costumes that only made sense in their own idiom. So Todd McFarlane's characters have a tendency to look very odd when they're drawn in a more conventional style, for example.
Yeah, and I wouldn't want to see, for instance, like Rob Liefeld redesigning Hawk and Dove. You know, Hawk's costume is just made up of pouches, full of pouches. Andrew also says, should heroes look contemporary? I think there's a middle ground to be had with that.
I think... again, it depends on the character. I assume Andrew's thinking more of the likes of, you know, do you want to update Superman, Batman? Mm-hmm. I think they are characters where the basic costume design is so familiar that you cannot depart from it too much.
They're also,
but you can tweak them.
Yeah, they're also very simple costume designs.
Yes.
You know, you can boil Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman down to, I mean, Wonder Woman's had a few costume redesigns over the years, and this is a kind of, you know, should superheroes look contemporary? You go back to the 1970s and the Diana Prince stuff where she was wearing these kind of bell-bottom trouser suits.
Mm.
Yeah, that looks dated now because it looked contemporary then.
I think you want some of these characters, you want the design to look timeless, and if you don't change it ever, it ends up looking dated.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you do need to just slightly alter it to fit with the style from time to time. There's nothing wrong with tweaking the details of the Superman shield,
mm-hmm,
or things like that, slightly altering the font.
Every artist does, really.
Well, officially, there is a particular design, and it's slightly different between the Earth 1 and Earth 2 Superman and things of that sort. The Golden Age Superman is in a different font from the Silver Age Superman.
Yeah, nowadays when you see artists drawing Superman shield,
they don't bother. But I think it's fine to do that sort of thing. It doesn't. I think if you try too hard to make Superman look now, then that doesn't work because that's not what Superman is about. The whole thing of Superman is that he is the archetypal hero. He should look as if he's been around forever.
Mm-hmm.
He should not look as though he was designed last week.
Yes, absolutely. He's the kind of guy who, because the costume is so well known, changing it too much is shooting yourself in the foot, because you get to the point where people don't recognise that it's supposed to be Superman. If you look at that new Superman costume that Jim Lee has done, if you didn't know any better, you would be like, is that supposed to be Superboy? Is that Superman 1 million? Is that, you know, who is that meant to be? And it's supposed to be ordinary Superman, apparently. Andrew also asked, in the wake of Kate Beaton's strong female heroes, are there some lady heroes who shouldn't wear trousers? He actually said shouldn't wear pants, but I think that's because he's gone native.
Poor man. I mean, in the vast majority of female characters, there is a sort of a logical point of, is this remotely practical?
Mm-hmm.
And I think, for the most part, I would prefer their costumes to be less stupid.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose the question, what characters are there where there would be a reason why they should not be wearing practical costumes? Mm-hmm. I mean, even Emma Frost wears trousers, for God's sake.
Yeah, she barely wears a top, but at least she wears trousers.
Electra?
In terms of, I suppose in that she jumps around a lot and you don't want things to get snagged and stuff. But I mean, so many superhero ladies wear sort of legging style costumes. Electra could easily do that, should she wish to, you know.
Ms. Marvel, actually. I mean, there is something about that costume design that kind of works with the thigh length boots.
I guess. I think the
design wouldn't work if you just extended it to a full bodysuit.
I don't think
it's a great costume, but I think the design, if you're going to go with something along those lines, it does actually kind of need to be that leotard and boots combo.
Well, I don't know, because you could extend it down and you basically change the chest logo and you've got Darkstar's costume, and that
exactly
works. Well, Darkstar's costume works fine. In terms of characters who shouldn't wear pants, I can only think of one. And that is only because of the style in which she is supposed to be drawn and what she's supposed to kind of represent and everything. That's Mary Marvel.
Mm.
Where all those characters, I mean, it's like saying, should we give Captain Marvel, a bigger cape that's not like a little dish towel hanging around his neck?
You know,
that is getting too far away from...
You're right, Mary Marvel, there's something a bit 50s retro about her. That kind of works. I mean, there's a few martial arts characters like Elektra and possibly Psylocke where you can make a case for bare legs, though not necessarily skirts. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Psylocke, I think, just needs to put some shorts on or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There must be some.
I think we've done reasonably well to come up with what we've come up with. Ben Russell, on a similar thing, says, what do DC costumes imply about the setting for this relaunch? I think all it implies is that they're going for a more kind of contemporary style of the characters and they're going for a younger look to their characters.
Well, they said that. I think that what they're saying about continuity is that they're trying to keep the key points in characters' histories, which they claim they've hand-selected, as opposed, presumably, to putting all of the old showcase volumes into a blender and picking out pages at random. But they say they've kept, you know, the key beats and characters' histories. Apparently, Batgirl was still Oracle.
Yeah.
She's
yeah.
just rehabilitated.
Mm. Okay.
So the The idea is that with less stuff in their continuity, but still with the key stuff there, the characters should be younger at an earlier stage in their careers, and you shouldn't get so many characters feeling, you know, complacently, I've been doing this for 10 years, I know what I'm doing. I kind of get where they're going with that. I think they do want the characters to be younger.
Yeah.
Superman possibly being the exception.
The new Superman looks a good bit younger.
But Grant Morrison's the solicitation for that talks about him being the first superhero.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if the idea they're going for is he actually is the first superhero. He's been there since the Golden Age. He's been there all along. He still looks young because he's immortal.
Yeah.
He's Superman. Now, the only problem with that really is you can't use Superman's parents because they'll be long dead.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, I think there's a lot to be said for that. I think in many ways, Superman's status as the archetypal superhero is more definitive of Superman than any of the actual character traits. Those are important, but fundamentally, he's the first superhero. A universe in which Superman Clark Kent is inspired to become Superman and thinks, I will be influenced by the costume of Dr. Midnight, doesn't work. Yes. He's got to be first. And I think there's a lot to be said for him being right there right from the start, and being the founding father that all the other characters are influenced by and look up to.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, I think they're trying to make it today, and they're trying to bring right forward the amount of the launch of the modern DC universe, maybe to something like 1996.
Yeah, well...
Not 1996, 2006.
I would say that would explain why so many of these characters look like they got dressed in 1996. The final topic that we've got is Ken Robinson says, if we had to make an Avengers stroke JLA type team out of characters from the official handbook of the official handbook of the Marvel Universe, who would we use?
Do you have the list to hand of who we've done?
It's on the other computer. I like Father Time, the bloke who walks around with a cloak and a scythe and a great big Eazy-E style clock around his neck. He was good, the time management superhero.
Madcap I genuinely do like. Who was the Skeleton Key?
Oh,
the man with the man with the power to pick virtually any lock.
Vic Slaughter, but he got brought back just recently in Wolverine.
He was used recently in Wolverine, the best there is.
Oh, someone's been listening to our show.
That thing has something like three different handbook characters in it. It was quite depressing.
Well, we could audition a new leader for the official handbook of the official handbook of the Marvel Universe. Because this week the Captain America, America's Avenger issue came out, and we've picked this week's particular poor sucker from that. This is a guy for whom Mountain Dew is a way of life. It's the hang gliding Night Flyer.
He was a hang gliding mercenary from the late 1970s.
Yeah.
A mercenary with his own hang glider, which operated independently of him and gave him power. You could defeat him by beating the hang glider.
It does seem slightly like, you know, the hang glider has got weapons all over it. He doesn't. We can either beat him or the hang glider. Which one will we choose? It's like he can send the hang glider off by itself to do his bidding.
Pop down the shops.
Exactly. The hang glider goes out to work for him. He sits at home and plays, L.A. Noir all day. It's a shame for the poor old hang glider.
It's quite a good costume design, actually, to be fair.
It's not awful. I've seen worse from late 1970s Captain America. He's got a very strange collection of character traits.
He does. I mean, you might think that it would be sufficient as a gimmick that you have a mercenary with your own hang glider.
It does sound like something from Bill Mantlo's run on Spectacular Spider-Man.
He's one of these sort of early extreme sports characters who possibly ought to be, you know, sharing a team with the Rocket Racer.
Mm-hmm.
But you'd think that would be enough. But no, there's more. The Night Flyer is apparently an artificial life form created by an unspecified other person. Get the feeling this is an aborted plot. Who served a mysterious master called the Voice of Death. And he is described as a cultist, a mystic, and a ritualist dedicated to the art of killing. So he's an artificial cultist with a hang glider.
Right. See, the thing is about the Night Flyer is that he has got very limited use, I would say, in terms of a combat situation. You basically have to be fighting people who are at the same vertical level or lower than you.
That's most people, to be fair.
Well, I don't know, if you start off at the top of a building. Because, if you're a Night Flyer and you're fighting Ms. Marvel, you're kind of screwed. You've got maybe a couple of minutes of fighting time until you land. All you're doing is gliding. He's not a flyer, he's a hang glider, man.
That is true. But he was... he does have fragmentation grenades. He's got a gun. He can fire energy blasts.
Thank goodness he's got a gun. So many of the villains that we do on this segment are just like, well, I've got an incredibly intricate gimmick and a gun.
He's also got the... strong enough to carry a young adult with one hand while flying. Although, in fairness, I think that would only be a very short flight before the hang glider crashed into a wall without him steering it.
Yes, and also it's the worst parenting ever. It's like, oh, I'm going to carry my kid to school. There's a school run with the Night Flyer, and the kid's just like, woo! And Night Flyer's just like, settle down, kid, I'm trying to steer this thing.
He's supposed to be obsessed with perfection, but for some reason ends up worshipping as the embodiment of perfection the Corruptor, a minor 1970s Iron Man villain.
Who you would think would be the opposite of the embodiment of perfection.
And he ends up getting into serious difficulties trying to beat the Teen Brigade. I mean, this guy is a bit of a loser, despite being repeatedly described by other characters as a top-level mercenary.
I think he's just describing himself as a top-level mercenary in company. And people are saying, well, that guy in the pub last night told me that the Night Flyer, apparently he's a cultist and an occult master. And he's
got a hang glider.
And he's dedicated to killing and he's got a hang glider. Do you reckon that the Night Flyer as a villain does not actually exist? He is just one long set of extravagant chat-up lines delivered in a bar by this alien life form.
A mystic hangler with a hang glider. Like, I think that's fantastic.
He's like, hey, baby, did I tell you I'm a martial artist? Yeah, I'm really great at hang gliding. Yeah, no, another drink? Yeah. It'd be really funny if he didn't exist at all. What I can see, actually, we could do with him is, you mentioned the Rocket Racer there. Rocket Racer and Night Flyer and Big Wheel... a Night Thrasher in a kind of Marvel Universe cannonball run from, you know, Thunderbolts Mountain to Avengers Mansion by any means possible.
You're picturing him in basically the Wacky Races.
Yeah, it's him versus, you know, Dazzler or whatever. She's on her roller skates and he's in his hang glider. He's the Dick Dastardly of this whole thing. If his villainous schemes all involved... flying slightly ahead of everybody else and turning a sign around so it points in the other direction.
What I quite like about this character is just the idea of taking, as a personality type, cultist and mystic, and then inexplicably nailing that onto something
like hang gliding. It does sound like they've just taken a load of nouns out of a box and just put them all together. It's like, okay,
cultist,
now
this Mr. supervillain... hang glider.
Yeah, it's pretty much... It's like, this supervillain is going to be a cyborg, time-travelling pig farmer? Okay. And thus the swine was born.
That's actually a better idea for a villain than half the ones Cable's fought over the years.
So the Night Flyer then, a guy who's got his place either as somebody doing ridiculous chat-ups in a bar, or as somebody who doesn't actually exist at all, or as somebody who's involved in the Wacky Races.
I love this character.
I think he'll be a great leader for our official handbook of the Marvel Universe team. Anyway, that is the end of the official handbook. It's the end of the podcast. We should hopefully see you in 2 weeks' time. Until then, you can catch us on our blog, which is housetoastonish.com.
You can follow us on Twitter. I'm Iv Destroyed and Al is House to Astonish.
Yep. You can email us. The email address is housetoastonish@gmail.com. And we've also got a Facebook fan page. Just go to Facebook, search for House to Astonish, and we are there. So we'll see you in a fortnight's time.
See you then.
Bye.
Bye.